Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us there was a good bounce in the Dow and the Russell 2000, but will the positive run continue past Labor Day? He checks in on gold, crude, and the U.S. and Canadian dollars. Tim Cyclesman Wood, editor of Cycles News and Views on cyclesman.com, gives us his view on stock market manipulation, the FBI raid on Mar-a-Lago, and whether the greenback and interest rates have topped out. Publisher of the RealEstateTiming.com newsletter, Robert Campbell, speaks to us from San Diego. Does he think an inverted yield curve means a recession is on the way? Whether commodities are a good bet? And is the U.S. real estate market about to tank? Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from American Manganese CTO Zarco Miselgia. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to the show, Ross.
Good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, what kind of week did we have on the major stock markets?
Can one say risk on? Yes, it's definitely that mode. You know, we go from a June, July, where everything is down and dirty, and great oversold readings, and now we're getting the rally. You know, here's a week where the S&P is up 3% on the week. You got good bounce in the Dow, the Russell, everything just getting a pretty good move. And, you know, when you're as badly when your sentiment is as bad as it was in the second quarter of this year, this is what you hope for in the summer. And, you know, volumes are light. It's easier for the market to rally. And typically, once you've got a summer rally, it'll take you in through Labor Day. And I think once we push through Labor Day and you get maybe around the 10th, 15th of September, it'll be time to be a little bit careful. You got some cycles and some seasonals that could be ready to put in a little bit of a high in there. So for now, enjoy the run. It's just methodical. You know, we had that great tested low. So enjoy the equity markets. And, you know, we've had some rotation. You got the oil market, which is going through just a consolidation phase here, but within a good dominant uptrend. And I still think that the oils have got lots of legs left in them here. And in particular, you know, these Canadian oils are looking pretty nice.
What's going on with gold?
Gold, we had that, you know, exhaustion high back in March, up at over $2,000. You got the capitulation at 1,700 in the middle of July, and now we're back at 1,800. There's some resistance in here, but I continue to think that there's still upside movement allowed here. As far as gold's concerned, we've retraced maybe about a third of the decline from the high, and wouldn't be at all surprised to see it test towards maybe the $1,900 level, a good $100 above where we are right now. None of the indicators have really gone into overbought territory, even though we've had this pretty decent move in the last 3 or 4 weeks. So, you know, you want to let it run, see what it's capable of doing. The, as I mentioned in the last couple of weeks here, not happy with the way the mining stocks are performing. So once this rally has run its course, Could be a pretty deep correction as far as gold is concerned before you can be thinking about a more prolonged rally. So enjoy this one for now, but don't overstay your welcome.
What's happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Currency-wise, you've got the Canadian dollar has surprisingly done, you know, not much at all. Here we are, we're stuck at this 78-cent level, and there's just, a tight trading range. You've got 77 on the bottom end, you've got 78.5 on the top end in the last couple of months. And without any big commodity price action, you know, you've got consolidation in oil, you've got a consolidation as far as the agricultural commodities are concerned, the wheat and corn and soybeans just in a backing and filling mode right now. So you're not getting any big guidance for the Canadian dollar. It's one of those things that if you're trying to make a trade out of it, you're going to have difficulty, I think. And as far as the U.S. dollar index is concerned, it's sitting right on a pretty good support area here around the 105 and change. Looking at the daily chart, you've got, as they say, support right here. You get to the weekly, you're probably more down around the 103 area for support. But rising trend for now, and and go with the trend rather than fight the trend.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Coming up, Tim Cyclesman Wood, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. I'm speaking to Tim Wood, founder of Cycles News and Views, online at cyclesman.com. He's speaking to us from Gulf Shores, Alabama. Tim, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Jim, thanks for having me.
Tim, I hear Gulf Shores is a resort town. What's it like there?
Well, it's your typical Gulf Coast beach town, I guess. I've been here almost 20 years and started coming down here in the 80s, and it's vastly changed. I mean, it was a sleepy little beach town. Now it is a known tourist destination with, from the locals' perspective, far too many people. it was a nice little place. You could go down to the beach, and now, you know, it's like everything else has been popularized. It's just overrun with people.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a nice place. I don't mean to be negative. It's a nice place. Obviously, people want to come here. They move here. And I heard that this area is one of the fastest growing areas in the nation.
Tim, can you tell us about your background, Cycles News and Views, and how people can subscribe?
Yeah. I got started in this probably 20 years ago, doing the research. I studied under a cycles guy by the name of Walter Bressert. And, he was, one of the board members. He, Peter Leides, a lot of the old school technicians, Robert Prechter. There was a institution, I believe it was in Chicago, the, study for the foundation of cycles, got a lot of their materials. And like I said, literally studied under Walter Bressert and got started. And, you know, cycle analysis is basically a means of trend quantification. You take the, you know, what looks like random movement, a movement of the stock market, and you try to quantify it and wrap statistics around it and develop expectations based on, those methods. And then, I also have, was fortunate to not personally meet, but to have an involvement with Richard Russell. And, he helped me get some of the original writings from Robert Ray, who worked, he was one of the predecessors of Charles H. Dow. And so I have those original writings
from the 1920s, 1930s. And, I incorporate that into my analysis as well.
Stock market manipulation. If the stock markets are manipulated, does the manipulation make it easier or tougher to predict market cycles?
Well, the cycles are still there. And so from that perspective, it makes no difference. But does it make it harder or more difficult to see a setup take hold and things turn? Yes, because the manipulation is an effort to combat, if you think about it, I mean, by mere definition, manipulation is an effort to combat the natural forces of the market. And this is why we've seen such extremes as we've seen in the current case. And you know, manipulation comes in many forms. If we think back, one classic example that comes to mind with manipulation is I was watching the cycles, and we tried to, back in 2018 or 19, it was in the winter, I remember, November, December time frame, October maybe, but I remember it was when the China thing was going on, and I remember it was so classic that Trump would come out with a tweet, or they'd have some kind of so-called news or whatever, but they would come out and say, oh, we got a deal. Oh, no, we don't have a deal. Oh, Zeig made a phone. You know, and it was ridiculous. And the whole time that was it going, we were moving into that, you know, that top, into that 2020 top, and the market was on edge, I mean, literally. And as I see it from my seat, this was all being used as a tool of manipulation to keep the thing going. So yes, they can, you know, the cycles are still there, but it can alter, you know, the meaning of those cycles, you know, the structure of those cycles. You know, interest rate changes, quantitative easing, repurchases and purchases, and who knows what else is that we can't see. These are all tools of manipulation. So yes, in one sense, it makes it more difficult. In the other sense, the cycles are still there, but they stretch them. And so, I guess that's the best answer I got. You know, we've seen with this bubble environment that we're in, we've seen virtually every statistic norm from virtually every discipline stretched beyond belief. Which, if you think about it, by definition, I mean, that's kind of what a bubble does, what these extremes do. So, yes, it does make it more difficult in that sense.
The stock markets peaked in January of this year and have since had a significant drop. So far, the stock markets bottomed on June 17th. Is this likely to be a significant bottom?
Yes and no. Yes, this was, as we moved into that low, I had timing, statistical-based timing, talking about the cycles, and we knew that there was an intermediate degree low due. Ideally, I was thinking that there was going to be one more push down, more like into the early July, but we were in the window for it, had a timing, you know, expectation based on timing, and so I knew that there was an intermediate degree low due, so from that perspective, no surprises. Circling back to your manipulation question, you know, anytime you have a low of any cyclical degree, particularly an intermediate degree cycle, you know, that's a footing for a higher degree advance to take hold. And we know, this is not an excuse, it's just reality, but we know that there is an effort to hold this thing up and manipulate, as you asked from the very get-go. And so the question is, Can this be manipulated into a higher degree bounce? I don't know. Nobody knows. Flip a coin. Throw a dart at a board. Whatever you want to say. But I can say this. Based on the structural developments, the evidence, that developed following the January high, every indication is we've seen a higher degree top take place, or a higher degree turn take hold. And this should be a counter trend rally. Now, whether it can be turned into something else through tools of manipulation, I don't know. It should be counter trend, though, based on normal cyclical behavior.
Are stock markets generally a predictor of the economy 9 to 12 months into the future?
I think, in theory, that used to be the case. But, again, this all takes us back to that manipulation thing, you know, which has fueled the biggest bubble ever. And, you know, we've consequently seen the biggest disconnect between the stock market and the economy in history. You know, if you look back at the post, 2009 recovery, and we talked about this some in some of our previous interviews, but that was the weakest, and I gave all kinds of statistics on the recovery, but that was the weakest recovery, and there was a few economists talking about this, but that was the weakest recovery in history. The post 2009, I wish I had those notes in front of me, but you know, some of the stuff that I was looking at was like the employment, the real employment growth rate. And, just, it was all, how do I say this? The statistics that were being touted were twisted to make that recovery look like something that it wasn't. When you looked at the raw vanilla data, that was the weakest economic recovery in history. And so, but yet look at the market. And then came 2020 and the COVID environment. And we've literally seeing the destruction of the economy. I mean, the supply chain issues. My wife was at a grocery store yesterday. She called me. She said, "You wouldn't believe the shelves is empty in this store." And you know, I see it. I go to the parts house and you know, we picked up some stuff not too long ago. And the guy said, "Go look at the oil aisle." I know people in the automotive business. We may have talked about this before. You know, the day you can't buy General Motors parts, the day General Motors doesn't have trucks on a lot in the southern part of this country, or Ford doesn't have cars on the lot, the day you see all this going on that's going on, this economy is going over the edge, but yet look at the stock market. So my argument is that no, I don't think that the market is in any way reflective of the real economy anymore.
Your thoughts on the Inflation Reduction Act?
I really don't have any other than that I failed to see, I didn't pay it a lot of attention, but I failed to see from what little bit I saw that I don't see how it has anything to do with inflation reduction at all.
It boosted taxes 5%, but taxes aren't included in the CPI. Was that a convenient omission?
Obviously, yes, and I understand it. There was a lot more IRS agents and some other stuff, but what did it really do? I mean, like I said, I didn't follow it that closely, but from what I saw just at a high level, what did it have to do with inflation reduction? And I'm asking you that question. I don't know. I don't think it had anything to do with it.
What are you hearing on the raid on Mar-a-Lago and President Trump by the FBI?
Well, I think it's like FDR said, you know, in politics, nothing happens by accident. And it goes something to the effect, I don't remember the exact quote, but if it happens, you bet it was well planned. You know, I've read enough history to know that this is true. I think anything in politics, I think that quote nails it. I don't think anything happens by accident. It's all planned. I definitely agree with that. And you talk politics and religion, you're going to make somebody mad. I'm not trying to make anybody mad. So you ask me my opinion, I'll give it to you. But I don't buy into this right-left narrative anymore. I've studied enough history, and I believe that quote. I think it's a right versus left. I've come to the conclusion that it's just actors playing their role. It divides people. It gives them false hopes. Well, if we can just get our guy in, you know, things will be better. No, nothing's going to be better. It's always a slippery slope to hell. And that's, you know, the path that we're on. So no, I think it was just another political stunt that'll probably be used, to divide people further. I think it probably, in one respect, as I look at it, I think it does legitimize Trump from the people on the right. You know, drives people toward him. But then what I think I see is another play coming to be further divisive. You know, I don't know what it's going to be. I'm just thinking out loud as I look at the theater. But, you know, on one hand, it kind of drives people toward it. But then on the other hand, they do another maneuver to block that somehow and create more division. It's just another political stunt, I think.
Could real estate crash without a stock market crash?
You know, I've learned one thing in this business. I've learned is never say never, but I think it's highly unlikely. And if you look back at 2009, I mean, this is all the post, bubble environment, or the post 2002 environment, where, you know, back to your original question, manipulation has become such a part of the market. You know, we're still in that environment, and I think that just as 2000, as we saw in 2009, that everything goes down together. I've been saying that all along, and I still believe that, absolutely.
Are we experiencing a debt of everything bubble?
From a debt perspective, this is the bubble is 6,500 times larger than that of the South Sea bubble. I found some numbers and in an old encyclopedia and did some dollar equivalent conversions, and it came out to be 6,500 times larger than the debt associated with the South Sea bubble. So you bet, it's one hell of a bubble. The question is, how long can it go on? And you know, I mean, I don't know. That's what they're fighting tooth and nail. Goes back to your original question about manipulation. That's exactly what we've been fighting, or they've been fighting.
Could the debt of everything bubble have been planned by the powers that be so they can buy up the world for pennies on the dollar while the World Economic Forum has provided the smokescreen for economic destruction?
You know, I can't disagree with that. And let me answer that. Let me answer that this way with an example. Following the 2009 low, which I remind you, well, let's go back one step further than that. Following the 2020 low, I mean the 2002 low, excuse me, I'll get my O's and 2's together here. Following the 2002 low, we saw where the Fed and the powers that be began to have an increasingly heavier hand in the market. And what I mean is that manipulation thing. We go back to that. And if you will remember, they wanted to bridge the gap. And what they did is, you know, they started having, like I said, more of an influence on the market. They pushed the 2007 top. That was longest extended four-year cycle for my seat, four-year cycle advance in the history of the market. And then what happened? It resulted in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. And yet, coming out of that low, we've seen more and more and more and more and more manipulation, more efforts to hold this thing, to blow it up into a bigger and bigger and bigger bubble. To put some numbers around that, I just found this. I covered this in a couple of letters ago, and I have it right here in front of me. But the Obama, following the 2009 low, the Obama, I forget what he called it, but his Recovery Act or whatever it was called, I forget the name they put on it. It was Obama's American Recovery Act, Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009. It was $800 billion. In March of 2020, following the decline, in the wake of the decline into the 2020 low, Trump passed the CARES Act. That was $2.2 trillion. And then that made that, so to put that in perspective, that was 2.75 times larger than Obama's, which at that time, let's go back, let me make sure that people are catching this. Obama's $800 billion in 2009 was the largest in history. Trump's CARES Act at $2.2 trillion was 2.75 times larger than that of Obama's. And then in December, Trump passed the COVID Relief Act, and that was another $2.3 trillion. And I'm not picking on Trump. I'm just telling you who passed it, okay? All right? In March of 2021, Biden administration, they passed their $1.9 trillion so-called American Rescue Plan Act. Following that, there was another $1.2. This was, again, obviously Biden administration, another $1.2 trillion. Under an infrastructure plan, which, brought the total, the total to, I'm having to pick through my letter to find this, to $7.6 trillion. And then from there, I've lost track. I don't know, but the last account I had as of the passage of that infrastructure plan was $7.6 trillion. So, I ask you this, how is it possible, or I answer that question with this question, how is it possible to know the minuscule, by comparison, the minuscule degree of manipulation or stimulus or however we want to term it that created the most extended 4-year cycle in the history of the market and the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression? How is it possible to do something of this degree and not expect at some point the same result? So, I don't know what's in somebody else's head, but that doesn't compute to me. So I maybe it's as simple as, you know, they just want to try to put it off as long as they can, but I it's created the biggest bubble in history, and it certainly makes you wonder if it wasn't by design, and that, you know, like you said, I forget how you worded it, but that the World Economic Forum is just a smokescreen. Quite possibly, yes.
What's to stop the central banks from just printing more and more money to get us out of this mess?
Well, the printing of more and more money is what got us in this mess. And, you know, that's not the answer. And it's really not money printing, because, like I said, it's really debt expansion. It's not money printing. And so far, they have been able to keep the inevitable at bay. But just as I've talked about with the numbers, it's taken an exponential, degree of effort, to do so. And so there's obviously a diminishing return. And how long can this go on? You know, I don't know. I mean, obviously, following the January top and everything that has happened since then, we're in an environment with this 4-year cycle top in equities where it is at risk of everything coming apart now. And it goes, again, we go right back to your question from the beginning about manipulation. I mean, can they hold it again through these methods? At some point, it's going to fail. They're not going to be able to hold it, or they're just going to back out. I don't know. But what I'm doing from my perspective is trying to offer people, I have developed tools that help us identify it like a gauge on your dashboard, if you will, through the eyes of a technician with the statistics, with the cyclical behavior, and with the entire setup, looking at interest rates, looking at commodities, looking at equities and the structure there, and tying things together with statistics and so on and so forth. That gives us the tools to see real time as it's trying to turn, how we're progressing, and if they are able to continue to hold it and when it starts to really crack. And so, I guess I've lost my train of thought, but I do think that the printing of the money is not the answer. It's the problem. And our job is to use the technical tools that we have, that I've developed, to monitor when we get to that inroad where it's no longer going to work, which we're kind of at that juncture. And again, can they save it again?
Are interest rates in a cycle? How high could interest rates go, and how long could it take them to get there?
Well, I don't think interest rates are going a lot higher. In fact, I think we're probably near the end of the rate hiking cycle. This has actually been a rather unique rate hiking cycle. In February, I have a Fed model. Going way back to February, I discovered that there is a phenomena, a marker. I can't explain it. It just is. It's like the sun rising in the east and setting in the west. I don't know why it's that way. It just is. But there was a marker that I saw with this rate hiking cycle that signaled that we were at the beginning of the end of the rate hiking cycle before the first rate hike ever even began. That signaled in February. Listen to what I'm saying. This thing signaled that we were at the beginning of the end of a rate hiking cycle. This is, and say it another way, this has always occurred after you have been in a rate hiking cycle and you're well into the cycle and you've been up for years, and then you get to this to the top of the cycle, you get the signal, and then down you come. This time, this occurred before the first rate hike ever even happened. And so I think that was a monumental, it doesn't mean the signal's not good. I mean, absolutely. But it tells you that something's not right. And so I think that this time interest rates were pushed in part with the reverse repos. We talked about that, putting a floor under the rates. And, that's a rabbit hole in and of itself that I'm just not going to go there here. But I think we're near the end of a rate hiking cycle. Once interest rates turning down is a key that I'm watching, it's a piece of the overall setup with commodities and equities and everything turning together.
Are these inflation and interest rate cycles different from previous ones?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Again, this interest rate cycle was driven, interest rates, how do I say this? If you look at the charts, interest rates didn't want to respond initially to the rise in commodity prices. And we talked about that. Remember, well, it's been so long ago, you may not, but interest rates were not buying the inflation narrative initially. And that told us something as well. It told us that it wasn't really monetary. And then as this inflation narrative was being pushed, if you will, if you look at it, really, it was all supply chain driven. And it's not a true, I know this may be a hard concept for some people to grasp. You just got to look at the data. And the data, again, is covered in great detail in numerous research letters. But this has not been a monetary-based inflationary bout, if you will, or cycle. It has strictly been supply chain. I say strictly, by and large, supply chain. And proof of that is the behavior of interest rates, because they did not initially respond, and they didn't respond until we saw the ramping up of the reverse repo. So there's your evidence, some of it. And then the dollar, the behavior of the dollar. The U.S. dollar, there's a four-year cycle in the dollar and a three-year cycle in commodities. Typically, as commodities peak, the dollar tends to bottom and vice versa. It's an inverse relationship, and they kind of meander when they're making that transition. But if you look at the data, they move in inverse direction. This has been the first, I want to say this another way, this has been not only the first three-year cycle advance in the CRB that the dollar has moved up with commodities, but it's also been the highest percentage advancing three-year cycle, single three-year cycle advance in the CRB, in the history of the CRB, and the dollar has moved up with it. So I would argue, no. I mean, there's the data. It's not been monetary. It has been, by and large, supply chain induced. So yes, you bet you. This time has been different. That's what interest rates has been telling us all along. That's what the actions that we've seen by the Fed and with the reverse repo operations has been telling us all along. Supply chain.
Is the U.S. dollar in a topping cycle?
It's in at least an intermediate term top. I'm not sure if it's going to turn into something bigger here, but Lana, let me give you some food for thought. The dollar is at virtually 20 years highs, or was. I mean, it moved back up. It was approaching the 2000, 2001 top, whatever it was. And, you know, it's done this, like I said, on the back of rising commodities. So they've gone up together. Commodities have peaked. And with the commodities having turned down, and the dollar is turning down, that's evidence. I mean, they both are. You know, we're seeing crude oil prices come down. We're seeing commodities starting to roll. Wrote about that in March. First started seeing it in late May. Wrote about it in the June letter. And so the evidence is that we're seeing the downturn in commodities and now the dollar. And so they're starting to turn together. If commodities really have peaked, then why would that relationship change? You know, so I've got my eye on that. I'm not saying it will. I'm not saying it won't. I'm saying they've been moving together. So if one's turned, why wouldn't they both have turned? That is a possibility. And at this point, though, all I can say on the dollar is that there is an intermediate degree top that is definitely in place. And there's one cycle degree higher that I think is in place. I don't know if we've seen the four-year top in the dollar yet or not. I can't prove or disprove that. That's something I'm monitoring. But, yes, we do have at least an intermediate degree top in the dollar.
Commodity prices have been increasing along with the value of the U.S. dollar. Is this normal?
No. I just talked about that. Now, that's pretty much what I just said. It's not normal. And like I said, I'll repeat it, though, but we have just seen, like I said, there's a three-year cycle in commodities and a four-year cycle in the dollar. And, you know, it's not perfect. They're not exactly 36 months and 48 months, but, you know, this is over time, you know, they approximate those durations. But typically what you see is when commodities bottom, you know, the dollar would be at some sort of a peak, and then they move in opposite directions. And like I said, this has been the highest percentage advance in the history of the CRB, this is the highest percentage advancing three-year cycle in the history of the CRB, and we've seen the dollar go up with it. So no, that is not normal. And again, that points back to, I think, that the fact that this has not been monetary, it's been supply chain induced.
What do you see ahead for commodity prices?
Well, I think the three-year cycle has peaked, and barring on I don't want to answer this. I think commodities have peaked based on all the evidence of previous three-year cycles. Every indication is they've peaked. And barring some unforeseen circumstances to keep commodities pumped up, I think they've peaked. I think this cycle has peaked. So I think the natural forces of the market are down, and that any bounce should be counter-trend. We are going into hurricane season, and, you know, if we get some storms in the Gulf, we could see some bounces in crude oil prices and that sort of thing. No doubt about that. That's typical. It should be retest or final pushes into that top at best, maybe like a final push retest of those higher degree tops. But I think the commodities have rounded the curve.
Tim, where can people go to find out more about and subscribe to Cycles News and Views?
Cyclesman.com. And like I said, my goal is to provide a statistical, quantifiable based approach to the meaning of the cyclical movements, which is, you know, again, cycles is nothing more than trend quantification, but you use the history to tell you, you know, to identify the turns, you know, when you're at an extreme, et cetera, et cetera. Have, you know, custom indicators and these statistics that we use and models to guide us. So far, you know, all of the expectations are pretty much on track this year. You know, we saw, like, for example, back in May, started seeing evidence that commodities had peaked and was right, you know, no question about that. In January, identified and saw that, you know, equities had rounded, it looked like they had rounded the turn and started seeing evidence of the four-year cycle top so far. You know, we have seen, weakness into the June low. I do think this is counter-trend, so that still appears to be on track. And then the one thing that I'm still looking for here is, I think this advance in interest rates is going to be short-lived. And, you know, I'm not saying we're at the top of the interest rate hiking cycle yet, but I think we're getting close. And, anyway, I cover that with, you know, all the models and details in the letter.
Tim, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you.
My guest has been Tim Wood, founder of Cycles News and Views, online at cyclesman.com. He was speaking to us from beautiful Gulf Shores, Alabama. Coming up, Robert Campbell, next on This Week in Money.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, author of Timing the Real Estate Market and the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter. You can find him online at realestatetiming.com. He's speaking to us from beautiful San Diego. Bob, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you very much, Jim. Looking forward to this as always.
Bob, when's the next Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter coming out?
And the next one will be September, on or before September 15th, 2022. I publish it every 2 months, and the last one was out in July 15th. So I'm about mid-issue right now.
Do you have an upcoming speaking engagement? Where, when, and what will you be talking about?
Yeah, I'm having my first live seminar in 3 years at the La Jolla Marriott. And the title is how I stopped worrying and learned to love inflation. And it's all about what to do during inflationary times. You know, how to preserve and protect your money and even make it grow, which is harder to do during inflationary times than most people believe.
So when is it?
Oh, it's on September 17th, 2022. September 17th, 2022. I know, I'm really looking forward to that. I'm old enough. I lived through the 1970s inflation. I was a kid in college during that period of time, but I know what it's like. Of course, when you're a kid in college, the things I was worried about in life were absolutely zero. No issues, nothing.
Cost of beer, maybe?
What, pardon?
The cost of beer?
The cost of beer. Nobody worried about anything. Hey, when I went to UCLA, the cost of tuition was $200 a quarter. I joined a fraternity, room and board, $400 a month. Nobody got loans. Nobody got loans to go to school. You know, I could work weekends on my dad, or work summers on my dad's construction site, make three times more money than anybody else because it's a skilled job. Most people don't know how to frame a house. And so you could pay for college. Everything was easy. Hey, when I graduated from UCLA, a house in Encinitas, which is a beach town here in San Diego, I could buy a home near the beach for $65,000. I could have got a job making $12,000 a year. I could afford a home and a two-year-old, you know, high-performance muscle car every 2 years. I mean, life was great back then. There was no problems, no worries, at least financially, especially when you compare them as to today. We're inflationary times. High inflation. The inflation during the 1970s here in the United States averaged 9% a year. That's big. Which is just exactly where we are right now. So now I've got a brain and I got some money. You got to figure out what to do with your money. What's going to give you the best odds of performing the best? And you got to go with those odds. So I'm sharing all my research with the followers that show up and you know, help them make the best decisions during these inflationary times.
Does your book Timing the Real Estate Market cover periods of rising inflation with rising interest rates and the effect on home prices?
It does not. It does not. My book Timing the Real Estate Market, that was strictly sharing what key indicators I follow that lead the housing market and don't lag it. So that you have advance notice on what's coming, whether prices are going to go up or down, and we're talking major cycles. But I didn't deal with the inflation during that period of time. Because one thing, the housing data hardly went back that far. You know, it's hard to get housing data that goes back, you know, to the mid-1960s through 1980. I mean, you got some in 1980, of course, but like mid-60s, that's when the inflation started. And it lasted like 14 years. So only now is the data becoming more available, but I do plan on publishing a new book, because I've tripled the level of knowledge what I know about real estate timing since I originally published my book back in, 21 years ago. And I may just include that topic if I can find data for it, because it's important. It's rare you go through inflations like we have right now. This is the first inflationary episode we've had here in the United States in over 40 years. So they are rare, thank God. Thank God we aren't Argentina or something. But when they do strike, you have to be prepared for those. It takes a whole different kind of investment mentality to survive an inflation versus a non-inflationary environment. You know, how you invest varies dramatically.
What's happening with the spread between the 10-year and 2-year Treasury yields?
It is the most, right now, it's negative by, the last I checked, 0.46 basis points, which indicates that a recession is on the way. And I think that's the most negative it's been almost in the last 40 years. Not that the spread actually matters. As long as it inverts, whether it inverts by 5 basis points, or 45 basis points. It doesn't matter. If you look at history, go back in history, you know, of that chart pattern, and go look at it. In 1989, The two-year was greater than the 10-year. The result? Recession. In 2000, it inverted. The two-year was greater than the 10-year. Recession. In 2007, the two-year was higher than the 10-year. Recession. Every time, guys, every time that happens, we have an inflation. And that's the kind of stuff you gotta look at from a probability standpoint and say, what am I, we looking at? Does it tell you whether the recession is going to be long and bad or short and easy? No, it doesn't tell you any of that. But you at least better be prepared for it. It's like knowing a train's coming down the track and you're on it. You think it's maybe a good idea to worry about that and maybe get off? So that changes your mentality too. Because what happens during recession, what's the outcome of recession? The unemployment rate goes up. People lose their jobs. Now, what does that mean? Now you got to sell your assets in order to survive. Like, let's say your home. Divorce rate goes up. Bankruptcy rate goes up. So all of a sudden, you lose your job, financial pressure, you know, you get a divorce, all of a sudden you have to sell your house. Like, under those conditions, during recessionary conditions, are real estate prices high or low? They're low. So now you got to sell your property at a low price just to liquidate because of certain life events. So that happens more often than not. That is the story of life. It's not people that start off with nothing and all of a sudden everybody's financially comfortable, by the age of 65. In fact, that number is only 4%. So I don't mean to scare everybody, but that's the reality of it. That's the reality of it. Nothing good in life comes easy. You got to fight for it, and you have to adjust to changing market conditions, changing life conditions. And if you do all those things, you have a chance.
Can stock markets and commodities run higher during times of rising inflation and rising interest rates?
Absolutely. In fact, I'll tell you guys what I'm recommending, my research I've done for my seminar. My first investment, and I'm invested in it now 100% in my retirement accounts, commodities. Commodities are going to roar, guys. They're going to roar. You're going to see commodity prices. They get double, triple, or even do more than that. But you just have to be patient. So I moved into commodities about a year ago. My entire Roth IRA, all of it. And it's going to stay there because I know the history of it. Are commodities volatile? You're damn right they're volatile. But what's the trend during these inflationary times? It's going to be up. It's going to be up big. Also, you should invest in gold. And just go back over time. Look at the 1970 inflationary period. Which asset classes outperformed others? Head and shoulders, commodities and gold. What sucked? Bonds, of course. Stock market. U.S. stock market lost 50% of its value on a real inflationary inflation-adjusted basis during the 1970s. So, I mean, you know, in other words, it may or may not do that this time, but there's better choices. You got to go with commodities, and commodities are so inexpensive. You go back 100 years, and you look at the ratio between commodities and the S&P 500, and that we are at like a low point that we haven't seen in 40 years. And you look at when that ratio gets real low, what happens afterwards? Things change. Commodities start going up, you know, much more rapidly relative to the stock market, and that's the place to be. So that's where you want your money. Use history as a guide, everybody. You know, use history as a guide. And what I tell people, what I do, it's more than just supply and demand. It's having historical perspective of how things change over time. Knowing what history is. You gotta understand supply and demand to call the term. But you have to look at history to know that these events happen on a fairly regular basis. Much more regular than you believe. And this time, will it be different? 90% chance the answer is no. It's gonna play out the same way. So that's what you do. You adjust.
Are there better and worse places for capital preservation during times of rising inflation and rising interest rates?
Sure. I mean, like, for example, right now, I'm not exactly sure what you can get with like a one-year CD in the bank, but I assume it's probably like about 2%. So inflation right now, the latest inflation read in the U.S. is 8.5%, which is meaningless. I mean, I would, because it's a government number, I would put at least 3 or 4% on top of that to get to the real world. So you don't want to, so in other words, you don't want to be in cash because you're losing, you know, 6.5% of your money on the basis of purchasing power. That's the worst place you want to be. And other places you don't want to be during inflation, you don't want to be in bonds. I mean, you know, back in the 70s, we called those certificates of confiscation. You're getting 5% on a government bond, and inflation's at 10% a year. You're losing 5% of your money every year by that investment. So just, you know, multiply that times 10 years, you just lost 50% of your money because you're stupid. So you have to move the money. And other things that do well, you know, of course, are commodities, are physical assets. It's not the best investment, but it's certainly not the worst. It'll hold its own. You know, and of course, the timing matters, you know, with it, when you buy and when you sell. But for example, during the 1970s in the United States, when consumer prices averaged 9% a year, U.S. housing prices went up 9% a year. So in other words, you were hedged perfectly. You didn't lose any money, you didn't make any money, at least according to those statistics. What I'm saying is, screw that, you know, sell some of your real estate, especially when the trend's down, and buy commodities and buy gold. And catch that up move. Then when that up move's over, you know, get out of those and go back into another asset class that offers, you know, more likely, you know, high returns.
What kind of home price drops could California and the U.S. be in for, especially if interest rates keep rising?
Even if interest rates don't keep rising, I think this down cycle has the potential to be just as bad, if not worse, than the bursting of the last bubble, guys. And that's not based, and all that's based on is looking at past cycles and the economic principle of reversion to the mean. Everything reverts back to normal. Everything in life reverts back to normal. Things go from being overpriced to underpriced, and then back to overpriced, because it's all based on human nature. That's what drives the cycle. And it does that over and over and over and over again, repeatedly. So that I honor those cycles. I look at them, and that's a tool for me to use to saying, okay, not only is the cycle over, how far are prices likely to drop? And I wouldn't be surprised to see California housing prices on a, let's talk real inflation-adjusted basis, drop minimum 50%, and U.S. will probably be in the range of minimum 35%. California is more, of course, because it's the volatility of the market here, housing market, is the highest in the country.
What do you make of the Inflation Reduction Act?
That's an excuse to print up $750 billion more dollars, as I read it. And that's going to help inflation? What are you, insane? It's crazy. It's politics, Jim. This is politics. This isn't doing something, Inflation Reduction Act, so you print up more money. These guys ever read Milton Friedman? He's a monetary policy. Inflation is a monetary event. You know, people dance around, it's more complicated than that. Yeah, I'm sure it is. But when it comes right down to it, can inflation best be identified as being a monetary event? Absolutely. So that's what you go with. That's where the percentage bet is. These guys are going to print. Taxpayers, they're not going to increase taxes to pay for that Inflation Reduction Act. It's all going to be printed and put on top of the national debt, which is just making matters worse.
Inflation versus deflation, your thoughts?
Again, I'm using history as a guideline. We haven't seen deflation anywhere in the United States or any, you know, almost anywhere in 40 or 50 years. Ever since the currencies, fiat currencies, were taken off the gold standard that gives license to the central banks to print as much money as possible. And just here in the United States, for example, you go back, you know, back to 1971 and look at the Consumer Price Index. I think there's been two episodes where it actually declined on a year-over-year basis. One was 4%. That may have been back during the 2007 through 2009 stock market crash. And the other time was somewhere before that. So it was 2%. Nobody's going to let anything deflate. The Federal Reserve Board is not going to let anything deflate because that would be a real disaster. You know, where housing prices drop 75%, the stock market drops 75%. You know, it'd be a situation like the 1930s. They're just not going to allow that to happen. They're not going to allow it to happen. They'll inflate their way out of this. No, not inflate their way, but they'll keep printing money, you know. You know, they would rather keep printing money to keep the wheels on the car than to actually fix the problem. So, inflation, absolutely, 100%. The odds of a deflation are like, I put it like, what, 2%?
What are your thoughts on the U.S. dollar?
Well, it's really strong, as many people may know. And the reason for that is that the U.S. is still the, you know, the prettiest of the three ugly sisters. So the money's coming in. You know where it's coming in from? It's coming in from Europe. It's coming in from Europe. You'd rather hold the euros, you know, falling. The European economy sucks. And, you know, that day of reckoning is rapidly approaching, and the people with money are getting their money out of Europe and bringing it to the U.S. You know, they're converting the euro into U.S. dollars, which drives the price up, and then using the U.S. dollars, you know, to buy assets like real estate or stocks or something. You know, they're certainly not going to leave it in a savings account making 2% a year when inflation's going off at 8.5%. I don't think anybody's that dumb.
What are you hearing on labor shortages and business productivity?
Oh, this is really good, guys. That I you know, I tune into some, that I don't listen to the evening news or, you know, Jim Cramer or any of that crap. Those guys are entertainers. They're good, but I don't need the entertainment. I just want the data. And a couple blogs that I follow a lot of blogs, really smart people, and they started tuning into this. In fact, recently a report was just issued, I think, in June of this year by the National Bureau of Economic Research. These are the guys that call recession. And they say because of what's happened in the last 2 years with COVID, or two and a half, 3 years, there is a 7 to 8 million shortage of employees in the United States. You see help wanted signs everywhere. Help, and don't ask me what's happened. I don't know what's happened. People dropped out of the workforce for some reason. The boomers retired. You know, whatever. We're 8 million short. So here we are right now in an economy with short 8 million American workers. And let's say the minimum wage is 16% or whatever it is, or something like that. You know, to get people back in those jobs, it's going to turn into a wage price spiral. They're not working for $16 an hour, willing to work, because there wouldn't be a shortage of 8 million employees. So how about 18? How about 20? How about 22? What number are you going to get to before you get the right number, the number of employees you need to most effectively operate your business? We're going to find that out. So what we're going to have is we're going to have a wage price spiral during these inflationary times. Because as most of you know, the number one cost of business is labor. Labor. So the minimum wage goes from, you know, 16, let's just say, to 20, which could happen overnight. That's a huge increase. That's a, you know, what is that? You know, 4/16, you know, that's a 20% increase. That's all getting passed on to the consumer. All of it, which is inflationary. The cost of doing business just went up. So the price of everything just went up. Because if you can't keep your price at the old price and pay your employees 20% more, you'll be out of business. So up goes the price. So that is really interesting. And it's not only the report from the National Bureau of Economic Research, another independent firm that I respect came out with the same report, and they came up with the same number using a different calculation. They came up with 7 million. So So businesses need 7 million people. They're offering $16 an hour. And people are going, nah, I don't think so. How about 18? Yeah, maybe it'll drop down to 6 million. You know, how about 20? Okay, maybe it'll drop down to, you know, 5 million or 4 million. How about 23? Yeah, maybe it's only 3,000 now. You're going to pay people in unskilled jobs $23 an hour? And it's not only that. It's not only that. If you look at what's happening to productivity in the United States, it's declining. And it's declined since, it's kind of flatlined for the 40 years. Now it's on a trend down since COVID. You know what? The work ethic is dead. So not only now productivity's way down, now you have to pay idiots $16 an hour even to get them to work for you. And are they productive? Do they care about their job? Most of them don't give a shit about their job. And they're crappy at it too. But the businesses can't afford to fire them because they can't be replaced. So productivity is falling. So now, here's what businesses are caught with. They're paying more for labor, and they're getting less productivity out of it. I mean, that's a bad combination, everybody.
Is the cost of energy still the elephant in the room?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the cost of oil is going to go to $250 a barrel, at least. And you know what's going to drive it there? It's going to drive supply and demand, which drives everything. So why is it going that high? Because these morons running the government that everybody's going to go green, which is the biggest fantasy I've ever heard of. Pretty soon there's going to be less oil, less oil, less oil, less oil available. Everybody's got their EV cars. And pretty soon you won't even be able to plug your EV car, recharge the battery in your electrical vehicle, because all the batteries are dead. Why are they dead? Because the sun quit shining for 12 hours or something. And then so what they're going to need is all of a sudden they're going to go back, holy cow, this was a big mistake. You know, we need oil. Yeah, you need oil, and the price is going to be $250 a barrel at that point in time. And how much is available? Not much, because everything's been shut down. That's what I think is going to happen. So in other words, get your bikes, everybody.
How does human psychology deal with changing markets?
Terribly. Terribly. Human nature amazes me. Everybody wants to buy something when it's expensive, and nobody wants to buy it when it's cheap. That's human nature, guys. And I know everybody thinks, you know what, geez, that's not me. Right, right, right. Sure it isn't. I mean, most likely it is. You have to recognize your own weaknesses. So, and how do you overcome that? Mindset is everything, everybody. You not only have to have a strong body. How you develop a strong mindset? Because you have to be willing to do what other people are unwilling to do. And that's the hard thing. Is it easy selling at the top when everybody's, you know, overbidding for property to get it? Yes, it's very easy because greed's a strong emotion. How about at the bottom? Is it easy to buy low when everybody's running for the hills? Oh, absolutely not. Fear's even a stronger emotion. So the only way to overcome those emotions and do well in the market, and I'm talking really well, guys, buy low, sell high is the golden rule of investing. You have to be mentally strong. You have to be able to stand up to the emotion, control your emotions and stand up to it and say, you know what? I need to do this. You know, the odds in life, the mathematical odds are with me enormously. I need to do that. And that takes mental strength. If you don't have mental strength, you'll never, ever do that. And if you don't have mental strength, the odds of you being an overperformer in life are low anyway. So that's something you have to develop. It's all mindset, everybody.
Could first world countries end up breaking up into pieces?
I think so. You know, that this isn't my area of expertise, but people that I know, I mean, say, could I see the U.S. breaking up? Absolutely. We are so divided. You know, the liberals hate the conservatives. The conservatives don't hate the liberals, but the liberals hate the conservatives. Us conservatives just think the liberals are crazy. But it's so strong, the emotion is so strong, I could easily see this breaking up. I mean, my wife, she's a history buff. I'm not. I love history, but I haven't had time to read it. She knows all about Europe. Go back 100 years in Europe and see how many countries have changed. How many big countries have turned into a lot smaller companies or they've changed their names. This is the way life is. It just hasn't been that way for the United States. So I could see that happening. I could really see that happening. You know the only way we're going to save this, and this came from Martin Armstrong, who's been a guest on your show many times, and I respect enormously. Martin Armstrong's personal theory on this, which I think he's probably correct, the only way to save the United States is take the power away from big central government and give it back to the states. So in other words, if we want to be, super liberal, super woke here in California, yeah, you can enact all those policies that everybody likes and enjoys and wants, and you can do it on your own. But let's say you want to be conservative, you like guns and you like guns. I mean, you know what guns are for, and you're conservative and you believe in small government and personal freedoms and, the right to speak and all that kind of stuff. Maybe you could move to Montana, and that's where those people hang out. And then you're good. But that's what it's going to take. This central government where we're going to tell every state in the world, exactly what to do. Obviously, that's not working out. So, one thing, saying it should happen and how it's going to happen are a totally different matter. I probably the only way it's going to happen is with a civil war. That's how I see it. But that's probably the first step to getting back to normal. Give the states back their independence so people can move around. I mean, I live here in Southern California, and I grew up in a beach town called Encinitas. I'm not moving away. We have the most perfect weather in the world, and I'm right on the beach, and I'm a beach boy. Okay, I'm not moving away for anything, right? I don't care what they do in California, as long as I can insulate myself. And, there's not that many crazies that go down to the beach or hang out near the beach. We tend to be, most of the people that are around the beach, for example, are, tend to be a little wealthier than average, maybe a lot wealthier. And most wealthy people tend to be conservatives in general, in mass. Are there exceptions? Oh, yeah. But in general, San Diego's probably the most conservative place in California. San Francisco being the worst. We're conservative down here. Way more than the average Californian. So I'm going to hang here in California, probably near the beach, for the rest of my life, just because I love the beach. Love the beach.
Take California, for example, a beautiful state. Some people like to control other people. Some people want freedom and to be left alone. Who stays and who moves out?
Well, I mean, I basically just talked about that. Like me, I believe in personal freedom. I believe in small government. Responsibility, very conservative. I'm going to stay, even if California becomes, a total liberal hellhole. Because I'm smart enough to be able to adjust the way I live, my wealth, so I don't have to put up with that crap. But I'm not leaving the beach. I'm not leaving it. Where else would I have to move, to get this kind of living condition? I don't know. My wife's 100% Sicilian. We might move to the, on the coast of Italy, on the Mediterranean Sea. I love Italians. They're good. They're good, hardworking people. And again, you get the climate. You're right on the ocean. I might consider that, but that's a long way away. Who knows how much longer I'm going to live? I'm 75. If I could live another 15 years, live to 90, at the pace I'm going at right now without slowing down, if somebody could say, would you take that? Would you rather be going full speed ahead like you are right now, Mr. Campbell? And know you're going to die at 90, or maybe live to 100 and be walking around with a cane. I'd take the 90. Wouldn't even be a choice. So, the place you could do it, the weather's got to be good. You got to be in a good environment at the beach. I'm not moving to St. Louis, I guarantee. I mean, I'm just not going to do it. So, and it's relatively safe down here. And, but other people, let's say, and I don't have to sell my home. I don't have to sell my overpriced San Diego home and move to Tucson or something and replace it with a home at one-third the cost so I have $1 million left over. I don't need to do that. I mean, if some people do, bless their heart, do it. Because you got to survive financially. You know, you're sitting here on a house that's worth $2 million. That's your only asset, but you have no income. That's not going to work. One, a house has to be maintained, which a lot of people, you know, find out eventually. And pretty soon you just don't have the money. You don't have the money to live, especially during inflation. Who cares? If you don't have income and your house goes from $2 million to $4 million, big deal. What are you going to do? The only way you can use that equity and get ahead is you got to move out of Southern California. You got to move out of California. And plenty of people are doing it too. There's more money coming in than that's going out right now. But I mean, that's slowly changing. From using median home price, which the National Association of Realtors does, the home prices in the United States went up 14.2% year over year in June. California, that number is 5.4%. So we're almost two-thirds less than the national average. So we could be slowing down faster than every place else just because our housing prices are the most insane. Insane! A single-family home in San Francisco City is now like $2.1 million. That's the median price zone. The median, $2.1 million. I mean, come on, guys. Are we all going to be billionaires before this is over because our houses are all going to be worth $500 million each? I mean, could that happen? Yeah, that could happen. Could happen very easily. You keep printing money, and it gets out of control, and the only way to keep the wheels on the car is print more money. Of course it can get out of control.
Could we end up seeing cash-only real estate transactions?
Yeah, we could. If inflation gets high enough, let's say inflation goes to 30% a year. You know what mortgages are going to be? 35% a year. I mean, theoretically. You know how much mortgage money is going to be available on a 30-year basis at 35% fixed rate with inflation going off at 30% a year? The answer is zero. So in other words, there are no mortgages. You either have the cash or you don't have the cash. And it's going to turn into a cash market. And that period of time typically can last, maybe 12 months. So that window of opportunity is there, but it doesn't last forever, like most opportunities, so you have to be willing to jump. So if you have your money in the right asset classes during an inflation, like, for example, in commodities, and all of a sudden real estate gets to a cash market, and they go, oh yeah, my house used to be worth $1 million, because people could go out and get a mortgage loan, you know, at 6% a year. What's the rate now? 35. There are no mortgage loans. So you can't get the bank to finance this purchase. So, in other words, you just have to have the money. Is that correct? Just slash the price by 80%. We got a deal. Deal. That's the way you make money, guys. You got to have that big picture. And when the right opportunity, it's the same with buying low in California real estate cycle. Those opportunities come along once every 12 years. But when they do, if you act upon them, you can get rich real fast. Real fast. Within 6 years, you can multiply your money by 1,000%. So there are those opportunities, and, you know, having the cash to buy in an all-cash market would be one of those opportunities.
How are your workouts going with your trainer?
Excellent. I just came back from my trainer today, guys. I'll tell you that I've been trying to lose 5 pounds over the last 2 years, and I do everything right. You know, I fast 16 hours a day. I eat the right foods. I work out. I run hills. I haven't been able to do it. Finally, I said, this is crazy. You know, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results, is insane. So I went and hired a trainer. Hired a young kid, 21 years old, real badass. And I said, I want to lose 5 pounds. And he goes, we'll lose at least 5 pounds. And so I've been my third training today, and you know what? And it feels great. He goes, you're going to lose more than 5 pounds with me, and I believe him. And the other secret to losing 5 pounds, I made another change in my life, guys. Another change. I love ice cream. I think, doesn't everybody love ice cream? I eat 4 to 5 pints a day. That's my addiction. And I said, okay, each of those pints of ice cream is 600 calories. Multiply times 5, that's 3,000 calories a week for ice cream. How many calories in a pound of fat? 3,200. Okay, so if I just eliminate the ice cream, you know, theoretically, I can lose a pound a week. Yeah. So I've been on this program like for 3 weeks, and I've lost 2 pounds because of that. So with training and just getting ice cream out of my life, I want to get down to a minimum of 175 pounds. And I'm 5'11". So, you know, and if I get down to 175, maybe a little lower, I'll have, I think I'll be close to having a six pack again. And that's my goal. So that's what you can do, guys. As far as my workouts, and workouts are something that if you haven't figured it out yet, your health by far is the most important aspect of your life. Absolutely. Confucius once said, a rich man wants 100 things, a man in poor health, only one. And you know what, guys? I'm not the richest guy in the world, but I'm certainly not the poorest. And that as I get older, do I need fancy cars to show everybody how successful I am, and, you know, and turn heads or Rolex watches? No, I don't need that. I'm spending my money on taking care of my health. Trainers are expensive. But I thought about it the other day, and I said, wow, you know, $100 an hour is a lot. And I looked and said, what's the disadvantage of not hiring this guy? Huge. Give him $1,000. I signed up for 10 trainings, you know. And I said, that's the way I'm going to spend my retirement money, you know, staying in perfect health. Because if you want to be, you know, what I said was mental strength is everything. If you want to be mentally strong, you have to be physically strong, guys. There's no way around it.
Bob, you're a mentor to people in health and finance. Do you have any mentors?
Yeah, I do. I do have mentors, or I say role models. One of my role models is a guy named Laird Hamilton. You ever heard that name, Jim?
No.
Big wave surfer. Greatest big wave surfer in the world. He's about 58 years old. He's still the baddest ass big wave surfer, and he's really good. He's in great physical shape, got a beautiful wife, been super successful, but it's his attitude. The other mentor I've developed in my life, one of the other ones recently, this is very recently, is a guy named David Goggins, who wrote that, he's an ex-Navy SEAL who wrote the book Can't Hurt Me. It's all about mental strength, guys. The Navy SEALs, that showed me it's all about mentally strong. That, you know, only 15% of all people invited to a Navy SEAL class graduate. Is it because they're like wimps when they got in and didn't know how to do push-ups or crybabies? No. They're all strong guys. So why do only 15% graduate? It's mental strength. You have to say, I don't care what you guys throw at me. And Navy SEALs are, you know, maybe the most elite fighting force in the United States. The only people that could be better are Army Delta guys. You know, but they're running neck and neck. And it's all about being mentally strong. That's what separates the guys that graduate from the guys that don't. The guys that graduate say, you can't hurt me. Whatever it takes, I'm gonna graduate. And the ones that can't say that, which is 85%, they're the ones that drop out. They're the losers. So you have to develop that. And the way to do that is physical strength, then mental strength, and you just have to have that attitude. I can do this. And are there gonna be failures? Of course! But is that ever gonna affect your attitude? No. Not at all. So I do have mentors. I do. And they're the most, these are the most ridiculous guys in the world. They set the bar so high that, you know, most people can't even come close to it. But that's why they're my mentors. I want to set the bar high. If I only get halfway, you know, I'm better than 99% of all Americans my age.
Robert, how can people find out more about your real estate timing letter?
You can go to my website, and thank you for asking, realestatetiming.com. realestatetiming.com. And I wrote a book that's on my fifth edition. I write a bi-monthly timing letter once every 2 months, 6 times a year, and describing, you know, housing conditions, where we are in the cycle all over the United States. I think it's 27 major cities in the United States, and you can check it out. And I even in there somewhere, there's a sample timing letter that you can look at. So it's, that's what you can do.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Hey, thank you for having me. Bye.
My guest has been Robert Campbell. Check out his website, realestatetiming.com. He was speaking to us from San Diego. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, T. Tim Cyclesman Wood, and Robert Campbell. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from American Manganese CTO Zarco Masalgia. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. I'm speaking with Zarco Masalgia. He's the Chief Technical Officer for American Manganese. Zarco, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
Zarco, you had a busy time in Ann Arbor, Michigan. What was going on there?
It was the NATBAT Battery Recycling Workshop. So that's NATBAT conference that we are members of. And I gotta say, I'm extremely happy to be traveling again, making new contacts in the industry and also meeting with friends. There's nothing like a personal connection. There were, at the event, there were EV, battery, cathode, and recycling companies sharing their thoughts. And what I think we could all agree is yet to be a defined battery recycling industry. We saw presentations on the regulations and difficulties around coordinating and transporting the incoming tsunami of batteries, which still seems unclear to me, as well as EV OEMs, precursor manufacturers, and cathode manufacturers presented on what they expect in the recycling industry, as well as a presentation from a battery manufacturer on the topic, which I really liked, and it was, will cell makers take recycling in-house? But overall, I think my time in Ann Arbor, Michigan was productive, and I felt that our beliefs and market analysis of the battery recycling industry, which is what has shaped our company's business strategy, is going on the right track. Unfortunately, for a demonstration plant, unfortunately I couldn't be in two places at once, but we do have a great team that was managing quite a smooth operation of the demonstration plant's leach stage. We have collected a lot of valuable data points that we'll need to analyze and report when available. I also want to, because we didn't do a podcast last week, but we did have a press release on the IRAP funding and advisory services that we received. So we did receive that from the NRC IRAP, and we are thankful for their support in past projects as well. It's always encouraging and gives us an opportunity to continue strengthening our process and its processing flexibility, with different projects and analysis of and feasibility studies that we're doing. So for example, it's been clear to us from the, many samples of black mass that we've received that not all battery pretreatment methods make the same quality of black mass. So this is that mechanical shredding process. Some containing high concentrations of fluoride, which does come from the electrolyte, and we don't want that fluoride going through our hydromet process. But reducing it to a consistent level could enable a streamlined feed of various black mass samples into, for instance, one hydromet process. And I also want to be clear that this does not slow down our demonstration plan project. This is a lab-scale feasibility work that is worked on in parallel. So we do have the capacity for that, and the demonstration plant is moving forward at the same time. And then in industry news and I guess politics as well, there was the announcement or proposal of the Inflation Reduction Act. In summary, this outlines the commitment to reduce CO2 emissions by 40% to 2030. It is ambitious, but when I realistically compare it to our recent life cycle assessment results, that showed the CO2 equivalent emissions we produce relative to mining or competing hydrometallurgical processes, I can see that there are, and we've shown that there are efficient methods that can help achieve these targeted reductions. So there's just about, I think, believe, $369 billion allocated towards energy security and climate change over the next decade. And I really want to highlight that, you know, over the next decade should remind listeners that these are still the very early days of this industry and our business. And we can see how much precedence is being placed on these topics. And I think, you know, even for listeners, I know many of them have been listening for many years. I should be really proud of their foresight in this, seeing this emerging industry that has, you know, countries completely focused on it and looking to put billions of dollars into their economies to grow these industries. Even better, in this Inflation Reduction Act, there's language around the sourcing requirements, which sourcing requirements is in terms of domestic sourcing, and this creates an enormous incentive for these auto and battery manufacturers to work with mining companies and recycling companies to invest and build out a North American EV supply chain. So, you know, Jim, we are focused, and I think this is only getting started.
Sarko, where are you traded, and how can people get more information?
We're traded on the Toronto Venture Exchange under the ticker symbol AMY, on the OTCQB under AMYZF, and the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under 2AM. Our company website is www.AmericanManganeseInc.com. There you'll find our contact information, emails, or you can reach us directly at the office at 778-574-4444.
Sarko, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Sarko Mashalgia. He's the Chief Technical Officer for American Manganese. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on August 11th.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.